Yeah, and that's one of the things, you know, so I was talking about one of the frustrations of the job. One of the things that, that makes it an absolute joy is seeing that, that first spark of understanding and interest that, well, hang on, right, now I'm beginning to understand why it tastes this way, and I can go off and explore a lot more on that. That's really why I, you know, the two reasons I do this job. One, and you touched on it in the chat that we had, I have a very deep passion for Glenfiddich as a brand, and I think it does get a lot of a bad press from the so-called enthusiast market. And I'm very passionate about trying to turn that around. So that's one of the reasons I do it. The other reason is I just love talking to people about whiskey. I love those light bulb moments when people just, you know, even a teeny halfpenny drops, and you just see somebody think, right, there's now a whole bunch of other stuff that I need to go off and find out just because of that one little bit of information.
Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of the Malted Muse podcast. Well, I think this must be the third episode in a row now that has started off with me apologising about something. And this time, I need to apologise to new followers on Twitter and also people who have started to like the Facebook page. Now, normally, I'm quite quick at saying thank you to people, especially on Twitter, for following me. But I just really am not getting the time or the space to get online anywhere near the amount that I need to do. And I have let it slip a little bit with Twitter, I will be honest with you. So there's a bit of a backlog of people that I'd like to thank for following me. Please accept this as my thank you for now. I will do it properly on Twitter when I get chance. But I do thank people for following me, both on Twitter, on Facebook, and of course, on listening to this podcast. Now, this podcast is going to be a telephone conversation I've had with Jamie Milne, an ambassador for Glenfiddich Distillery, and the voice you heard at the very beginning of this episode. It was not an easy interview to set up. Jamie is a very busy man, and he's out on the move an awful lot. When I was talking to him, he said to me that he must spend about 70% of his life living out of a suitcase at the moment. So I really am very grateful to him for spending the very small amount of time that he had free talking to me. It is an interesting chat because obviously Jamie knows a lot about Glenfiddich, but it's the anticipation as well with me of having waited to talk to him for some time to then actually get to talk to him was a real treat. And it was something that happened not perhaps at the best time for me. I was out in the open, it was over the phone, and that is why, if you listen carefully, you'll hear the sound of birds singing and cawing in the background quite a bit. I apologise about that. I also apologise about the fact that we lost signal halfway through, so there's a slight hiccup at that point. I'm sure you'll see where it is. But it was a treat, it is very informative, and certainly put me right about something, that is the shape of the Glenfiddich bottle, the reasoning behind that. But why talk anymore? There is a reason for this interview. There's a reason why I wanted to talk about Glenfiddich, and those reasons were twofold. You see, I first approached Jamie shortly after I did the episode about Belvinnie. That was an interesting episode for me. I had a daughter who was in the hospital at the time, and I did that interview from a hospital corridor. This one wasn't quite as dramatic as that, but that was quite a few episodes ago. And I contacted Jamie, and Jamie was quite rightly of the opinion that really it would make sense just to hold off doing an episode about Glenfiddich for a little bit because there was some news coming. And then I got an invitation to go to London in March to attend a press release about the Age of Discovery, the 1974 vintage reserve, and the 21-year-old. And I have been kicking myself because I just wasn't able to go there. I asked my son whether he would like to go in my stead. He's a journalist. He lives in London. He likes whiskey. He wasn't able to go. And so it went on. But I'm so grateful to Glenfiddich. They have sent me samples of those three whiskies. I will be honest, I've had a really bad cold. And I didn't want to waste such fine spirit, such fine whiskey, on what would have been a very tired and mucked up palate. I think it deserved a bit more than my palate's been of late. So I've not yet tasted those. I'm really looking forward to tasting them. And when I do taste them, I'll let you know what I think of them. But in the meantime, let's listen to the conversation I had with Jamie Milne from Glenfiddich.
Jamie, it's so good of you to agree to talk to me. We're going to talk about Glenfiddich. Now,
okay.
Glenfiddich's an awfully well-known whiskey. What? Very briefly, what's the story behind it?
The story behind Glenfiddich is really one of, I think it's a story of one man's determination to follow through on a dream that he had. That's the way that I kind of sum it up for people. And I think even having said that, I doubt whether William Grant, the founder of Glenfiddich, would have dreamed that one day his malt distillery would have become the biggest malt brand in the world. He certainly wanted to be the best whiskey in Dufta, and he had the dream was the best dram in the valley, but I doubt he would have ever believed that it would become the most popular in the world. So William Grant, born in Dufftown, worked for 20 years at another distillery, Mortlach in Dufftown, which was the first distillery in Dufftown. And it wasn't until he was about 46, 47 that he actually had all the pieces in place, so the finance found the right place to build his own distillery. And that's when he started to build Glenfiddich with the help of his family. So that was 1886 through to 1887, and it was Christmas Day 1887 when the first spirit came off the still to him.
Yeah. But that's not the only distillery he then built, is it? He then moved on to build...
Yeah, well,
the road, so to speak.
Just a mile down the road. So about 4 years after he had built Glenfiddich, he was probably, and I am guessing here, he was probably faced with a decision whether he wanted to expand Glenfiddich because it was very popular, or whether he would build another distillery. And I am guessing here, but I know he was a very shrewd man, and I know that the family are all very clever as well. So my guess is that he thought, okay, I could expand Glenfiddich, or if I build another distillery, I then have two different whiskies, and that makes me more appealing to blenders, and I can blend my own. So that's what I think the thought process was. And that's when he built Balvenie Distillery, just down the road from Glenfiddich. That was 1892. And then a few years after that, again, prescience, he kind of foresaw the problem with the Patterson crash and started blending his own blended whiskey, Grant's blended whiskey, towards the end of the 1800s. So, to be honest, if he hadn't made that decision to make his own blend, who knows whether we would still be here today, because a lot of people, a lot of distilleries went to the wall during the Patterson crash.
So you brought up a whole range of issues there, yeah. So that was one way of surviving the Patterson crash. It showed an awful lot of foresight in many ways. But it's also, I find, quite interesting that the decision was made there to be independent, really, with making your own blend. But, of course, Glenfiddich's also well known as being one of the early, if not the earliest, promoted single malts?
Yeah, well, as you know, and as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, blended whiskey was really king, and to a large extent, blended whiskey is still king. Over 90% of Scotch whiskey sold around the world is blended whiskey. Let's never forget that. Mm. But in the late 50s and into the early 60s, the chairman of Grant's at the time, Sandy Grant Gordon, really started to listen to the people around him, and they, everyone who made whiskey, everyone who drank whiskey in Scotland was saying, well, you know, malt whiskey seems to be the thing to drink. But you couldn't really buy malt whiskey outside Scotland at the time. It seems ridiculous now in 2012 to think that in the early 60s you could only really buy malt whiskey in Scotland, but that was the case. And, you know, the guys at Glenfiddich, Sandy Grant Gordon, chief among them, said, let's start marketing Glenfiddich outside Scotland. And that's really where the brand started to be built from. It was a deliberate action. And yeah, you're right. I mean, in through the 1800s and into the first half of the 1900s, blended whiskey was really what people could buy, what people were drinking, except in Scotland, where you could buy single malt whiskey, but you really couldn't buy single malt whiskey outside of Scotland, which does seem ridiculous to us in 2012 to think that, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, you couldn't get single malt whiskey outside Scotland. Mm. So at the time, Sandy Grant Gordon, who was chairman of Grant's at that time, he made the decision based on what he was hearing around him. People were saying, look, malt whiskey seems to be the thing to be drinking. Everyone who made whiskey seemed to be enjoying drinking malt whiskey. And we made the deliberate decision to start selling and marketing Glenfiddich single malt as a brand. Initially, it was called Glenfiddich straight malt, but you know the iconic triangular green bottle was brought in just ahead of that, so that we had an iconic image to help us make sure that people recognised this new straight malt, as it was back in 1963.
Well, Jim, can I just ask you about that triangular bottle?
Yep.
Where did the inspiration for the triangular shape come from?
Well, the design was actually created by a chap called Hans Schlager, and it was originally designed for the Grant blended whiskey as a clear bottle, and introduced for that in, I think, 1957. Now, Hans Schlager was quite a prolific designer, obviously not a native of the UK, but lived and worked in the UK for much of his life. And he also designed some of the signage for the London transport network, like underground and buses and things like that, things that people, you know, really iconic images that people recognise. And his idea was to try and represent the three ingredients that are used for making whiskey. So for malt whiskey, water, barley, and yeast. So that's where the idea of the three sides comes from.
That's wonderful. Well, it has nothing to do with packing potential or anything like that. It is an artistic statement in many ways.
Well, you know, if I ask any designer, it's always about bringing together art and practicality. And the great thing about triangular bottles, especially if you're a sailor, I don't know if you sail, Jim, but for anyone that likes to go out on the boat at the weekend, if you pop the triangular bottle down on its side, it doesn't tend to roll around quite as much when the waves get up.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you talked earlier on about Balvenie. How does Glenfiddich differ from Balvenie?
In terms of the spirit, the whiskey, or in terms of the ethos behind the distillery?
Well, both really. I'm thinking more along the lines of the flavour profile. I'm thinking on behalf of listeners who might be listening in for the first time, are very new to whiskey, and thinking, right, well, if I have to buy a Balvenie or a Glenfiddich, how do I know which is going to be the one that suits me the best, sort of thing?
Yeah, okay, well, I always encourage people to try whiskies, even if they think they know what they like. you should always take any opportunity to try something that you haven't tried before, because you just never know. You know, every whiskey is different, and every expression from every distillery is different. So you just have to keep exploring, really. But you know, the key difference, or the key similarity, really, between Glenfiddich and Balvenie is that they are both what I would describe as classic Speyside single malts. So you've got the fruitiness, you've got the sweetness, you've got the sort of barley cereal character coming through. But they are very different. Glenfiddich is the signature style of Glenfiddich in the 12-year-old is famously fresh pear, maybe a bit of apple. So those sorts of green fruit flavors. And the signature style for Balvenie that comes through really strongly in Balvenie signature 12-year-old is honey. It's a honey sweet malt whiskey. That's the house style.
Okay, thank you for that, Jamie. I don't want to talk too much about Balvenie here, because, of course, what we're wanting to talk about is Glenfiddich. One more question about Glenfiddich in general before we talk about the specific thing we want to talk about here, which is, of course, Glenfiddich's a very, very well-known name. Does that have its drawbacks, do you think, the fact that it is so well-known?
I think it can do. I think there are certainly people out there who, and I think we're very good at this, or very bad at this, depending on your point of view. We're very good at this in Scotland. We always like to knock the big guy, whatever they're successful at. If you look at Andy Murray, who actually is an incredibly successful young tennis player, and yet Scotland are always very, very quick. Scottish people are very quick to knock him when he doesn't win a final. So we're extremely good at knocking the big guy, if you like, and I think that's certainly the case with Glenfiddich as a whisky, as with anything else. But I think what we are seeing is that people are becoming more open-minded, and a lot of people who have possibly tried it in the past and maybe feel that they've moved on are actually, because we're making it easier to come and find us at whisky festivals and through tastings in bars and so on all around the country, people aren't scared to come and try again. And very often people are quite surprised, because your palate does change as you grow older. And if someone has tried Glenfiddich back in the late 90s or early 2000s, not only has their palate changed, but actually our whisky has changed a little bit since. Well, we always talk about it being exactly the same, but we have been improving the quality of casks at the distillery, and that has come through in the liquids. So Glenfiddich 12-year-old today is a little bit different to what some people might remember.
Yeah. Well, of course, the other thing that you do is that you are bringing out new releases, and you've done that recently. I'm still kicking myself because I was invited to a press event down in London by yourself too.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get down there, which caused me a few problems, to be honest with you, because I spent quite a few days in a bad mood trying to find a way to get down there. Tell me a bit about this new release that's come out, this to put words into your mouth here, The Dawning of a New Age.
Well, the one that I think you're speaking about specifically would be the Age of Discovery Madeira cask finish, is that right?
Yeah.
So this one, for us, it's the first time that we've released specifically a 19-year-old whisky. People often ask about the ages and how important is age. And well, age is important. It's always one factor, but it is just one part of the jigsaw puzzle, if you like, of creating the character of a whiskey. So this is a 19-year-old. It spends most of those 19 years in primarily used American oak casks. And then for the last few months of its maturation, we move it across into oak casks that have previously held Madeira from the island of Madeira. And that gives a very, very different additional flavours that you wouldn't expect to find in a Glenfiddich of that age. So, you know, we mentioned earlier, Glenfiddich House style is fresh green fruit, and that does change as it gets older. By the time our core 18-year-old has matured to that age, we really think the flavours in that are more like a baked apple. So it's kind of changed from fresh fruit to baked fruit, if you like. So some of that comes through in the age of discovery as a 19-year-old, but it's also wrapped around with the sort of richer, deeper fruity flavours that you'd expect from Madeira-influenced casks. And we do have to be really careful there. You know, what we're not doing is adding Madeira to Glenfiddich. These are casks that have had Madeira in them, and the key thing for us is how that Madeira has reacted with the oak. So what our malt master Brian Kinsman is trying to do is use that influence. So it's oak that has had Madeira in it, which is then influencing the flavour of the Glenfiddich right at the end of maturation.
Sure. But I mean, there's more to wood quality than just what's been in it before. So presumably, you're actually also being very careful about the cask itself. It's not just that it's had Madeira in it. So I'm sort of trying to emphasise what you're saying here. Is that combination of the wood, what's been in it before, how they've reacted, and then how it's going to react to the spirit you're putting in there?
Yeah. From what I've been able to find out talking to Brian Kinsman about it, there was a lot of work went into sourcing exactly the right type of casks from exactly the right Madeira producer, which I think was Enriquez. And they did put a lot of effort into that, because you have to find someone who's happy to work with you, primarily, and find someone who, once they're happy to work with you, is happy to help you explore the various options that might be available to find the one that is going to work best for your whiskey. Because as we said earlier, all whiskies are different, and one type of cask might work very well for another malt whiskey, but wouldn't very well for Glenfiddich.
Mm. Why the name Age of Discovery?
Why Age of Discovery? Well, Glenfiddich at the moment is very much trying to remind people of our, as we mentioned earlier, our pioneering credentials. So, you know, back in the 60s, really becoming the single malt that opened up the category the way we know it today. And we're trying to reflect that. So one of our key advertising campaigns just now, there's the main slogan on that, if you like, is "One Day You Will," which is really trying to get people to think about what inspires them, what their dreams are. You know, we're not trying to say one day you will drink Glenfiddich. It's not as literal as that. We're just trying to get people to open their minds up a little bit. So things like exploration and discovery are themes that are very important to us. The Age of Discovery is actually going to be a new sub-range, if you like. The Age of Discovery Madeira cask was launched about this time last year, initially into duty-free travel retail, and it was exclusive to them for the best part of a year, and now we've been able to launch it into UK domestic. So what will happen now is that a new Age of Discovery expression will then be released into travel retail, probably for around a year, and then that will follow the Madeira finish into the domestic market. So it's not designed to replace our core range, the ones that everyone knows, the 12, 15, the 18. It's designed to sit alongside that. And certainly, if you've seen the packaging for it, you know, it's a jet black bottle, beautiful cream label, and the outer casing. For the Madeira one, it's designed to reflect the explorers from 15th century Portugal. So it has those oldie worldy maps on the outside of it, which I think are fantastic. I've got a few of those in the house, actually, those old maps.
And alongside this, of course, you have got the other whiskies, as you said, the not in competition with, not replacing, but are going alongside of. You've got your core range, and I just find it interesting that you have things like titles like The Age of Discovery. You also have Vintage Reserve. Do you know what I mean? Which is sort of tends to think the other way, looking towards the past. But of course, discovery is not just to do with discovering new things. You can discover ancient gems as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the Vintage Reserve is a good one to talk about as well. We at that event that you were sadly unable to get to, we unveiled the 1974 Vintage Reserve that has just been launched onto the UK market as well. And that's one that I'm very fond of. I'm a little biased because I was very fortunate to be involved in the selection process of that last summer, along with many of my ambassador colleagues from all around the world. We got together at the distillery, along with Ian Miller, the global ambassador, and Brian Kinsman, the malt master. We had three different options to pick from, a 73, a 74, and a 75. And I can assure you there was some vigorous debate around the table to begin with. But as time went on, and this is something that's also really important, and maybe some of your less experienced listeners might not realize this, but if you leave whiskey in a glass for any period of time, it does become different. It does change while it's in the glass as it's reacting with the air and the warmth of the room around it. And so what we found was as the three different options sat in the glass, the one that absolutely stood out a mile just as changing and evolving and just opening up new flavors over time was very much the 1974, which we selected as the new vintage.
Yeah, marvellous. John, can I just go back a few steps? When we're talking about the age of discovery, you mentioned the word explorers.
Yep.
Now, I don't know if you want to say something about explorers in connection with the website that you have.
Well, absolutely. The website underwent a fairly major overhaul a couple of years ago. And we're trying to, again, in keeping with this idea of hoping to inspire people to look at new things, we've introduced a lot of information on there of things that people might want to do that they've never thought about doing. So unusual hotels, like underground hotels or ice hotels and all these kinds of things, great places to have drinks, all sorts of...
So not all just directly whiskey related, but it's more to do with experience, opening up your minds and...
Yeah, and just having more of a lust for life, I suppose, would be one of the ways to look at it. And obviously, we are a single malt whisky, so there's plenty of stuff on there about the distillery and about the whiskies that we make. But if people want to sign up to Explorers, we're definitely not spam merchants. You'll get occasional emails from us, and really we leave it to you to have a look around the website and engage with us however you want. You can also, if people are interested, I'm on Twitter. I'm still getting used to it, and I'm sometimes not as quick at responding as I'd like to be, but you'll find me at GlenfiddichJM if you're on Twitter. And yeah, the great thing about having all of these different channels available to us is that I can actually be in many places all at once. So if someone, let's say in Manchester, has a question, they don't have to wait until I'm doing a tasting in Manchester to come and ask me it. Yeah. They can just ping that question up on Twitter. And if I know the answer, I'll answer it as quickly as I can. If I don't, I'll go off and try and find out. Because if I don't know it, then it helps me to learn and expand my knowledge too, which I love doing.
Sure. Well, John, as we're talking about you for the moment, how did you get involved in this trade?
How did I get involved in this? Well, I really was kind of born into it to an extent. That's maybe overstating it a little bit, but my dad was a customs and excise officer, and my first few years of life were spent in the shadow of Cameron Bridge Grain Distillery in Fife, because he was one of the excise officers on site at Cameron Bridge. And a few years after that, I think I was about 7 years old, we moved up to Speyside. My dad took over responsibility for a few distilleries as the exciseman in Speyside. And really, I just spent an awful lot of time in distilleries with my dad, talking to the workmen there, understanding how they make whiskey, what were these funny smells that I could smell. So it really was something that, you know, if you live in Speyside, I grew up in Keith, it's hard not to really be exposed to distilleries. They're all around you. There are over 40 distilleries just in Speyside alone. But my first real experience with Glenfiddich and with William Grant & Sons was in 1990, when I left school and I was had a summer job before I went to university as a tour guide at Glenfiddich Distillery. And I was there for, I think, five summer seasons while I was at university. I actually met my wife while we were both working as tour guides there as well. So Glenfiddich is very important to both of us, as you can probably understand.
Yeah. And no regrets. Not when you look back over the years, you don't think to yourself, "Well, I wish I'd gone into, I don't know, some other occupation."
Well, the funny thing is that I did go into some other occupation. Right. I spent 15 years working my way through the ranks in IT and project management and management consultancy. So, you know, I finished at university. I'd actually spent 4 years studying aerospace engineering, and during those 4 years, the British aerospace industry reduced from quite successful to almost non-existent. So I did have to try and find something else that I thought I could do. IT was that thing, and I did that for 15 years, finishing up working for a consultancy company in Ipswich, working with a lot of clients down in London. But then a couple of years ago, my wife and I were looking at moving back to Scotland, and the opportunity came up to apply for the brand ambassador role with Glenfiddich. I threw my hat into the ring, and here we are 2 years later. I've been having genuinely an absolute whale of a time. It's a fantastic job. You meet so many interesting and different people, and you know, even talking to people like yourself on the phone, it's something that I have a real passion for. I never ever claim to be an expert about whiskey, because I know there are so many people out there who know way more than I do. And if I can just help other people start to lift the lid a little bit on some of the wonderful whiskies that are out there, I think that's a great way to spend your time, isn't it?
Oh, I reckon that a good 90-odd% of people listening to you say that are just going to be full of jealousy, to be honest.
Yeah, all of those other people who, like I used to be, are stuck in a cubicle somewhere, down in the square mile, wondering when the day's coming to an end and the weekend begins. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, or people like me that are stuck up in Derbyshire thinking, well, how can I get to this press conference? Does it ever surprise you just how much enthusiasm people have for whiskey?
Does it ever surprise me? I don't think it does surprise me. I think some of the things that surprise me is it's not so much the enthusiasm. It can be, it's the fervor. When it goes beyond enthusiasm, and people really do become almost crazed by pursuit of the next unique bottling from a certain distillery or something. It's fantastic for the industry, don't get me wrong, but I guess it's like anything else, isn't it? If something becomes an absolute driving passion for someone to the exclusion of almost everything else, then that is the thing they will put their absolute heart and soul and all their energy into. Sure. I think occasionally the extreme enthusiasm maybe surprises me, but like I said earlier, I grew up surrounded by distilleries. I grew up actually during a time time when a lot of distilleries were being closed down during the last really bad downturn in the 80s. And for me, it's absolutely wonderful to see so many distilleries reopening and new distilleries being built. You know, back in the 80s, who'd have thought we would be building new distilleries?
Hmm. Yeah. So it's good news at the moment. I can understand what you're saying about people being a bit over the top sometimes, the amount of fervour. There's something about whiskey, I think, that can actually just grab hold of people. And I'm not talking about the alcoholic effect. It's just...
No, not at all.
It's very hard to actually explain what it is. I think that might well be a podcast episode in its own right, trying to understand what that is.
But like I say, Jim, you know, the enthusiasm and fervour, whatever you are passionate about, whether it's whiskey or football, it doesn't matter what it is, you will always get people who take it to the, you know, turn it up to 11, to quote Spinal Tap.
That's marvellous. Jeremy, thank you ever so much for talking. It's been really helpful. Very, very interesting. Before you go, is there anything that you feel that we've missed out on here that the listeners ought to know about?
Is there anything that we've missed out on? Do you know, we've covered, for me, we've covered quite a lot. We've talked about the origins and the history of Glenfiddich. We've talked about where we are just now with some new releases. People have kind of understood a little bit about me and where I've come from. And I think that maybe the only thing we haven't spoken about is the future. Mm. And the future is always a very difficult thing to predict. and I think really what we spoke about earlier with Age of Discovery, that range is going to be a very key part of what we do going forwards. But also, you know, the definitely going to need an edit here. I'm trying to think of the best way of summing up some of the things that are coming in the future without giving away things that I'm not quite supposed to talk about at this stage.
Would it be safe to say that there's more exciting things on the way, that watch this space, keep looking at the website, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you're probably right, yeah.
I mean, one thing I'll add to that, if you don't mind, and do feel free to disagree with me, but one of the drawbacks that a company can have when they become really popular and really successful is that of complacency and mm-hmm. sitting back. And I think the fact that Glenfiddich are doing things like Explorers, doing things like the Age of Discovery and new releases, and being very specific about quality and things like that, all suggests that that's not a trap that they've fallen into. So I'm going to presume that in the future they are going to continue to strive towards perfection and strive also towards experimentation and putting new things out there for people.
I think you've summed it up very, very nicely, actually. Where, you know, perfection is something you can only ever strive for, but the key thing for Glenfiddich, for the last, I would say for the last 15 years, and certainly going forwards, has been very much that, what you spoke about, experimentation, innovation. If you look at how we make the 15-year-old using that Solera system that we have for that, which I'm sure we could go into at huge length some other time, no one else makes whiskey that way. We brought out a 14-year-old rich oak 2 years ago, that's cask finished using virgin American casks and virgin Spanish oak casks. No one else has done that. Mm. And we are constantly just looking for just these little things that no one else has tried, and we'll try them out and see if they work.
Yeah.
If they don't work, we don't bottle it. It's as simple as that. And that comes back to the perfection thing.
I mean, you've mentioned the Solera system. I suppose we ought to very, very briefly mention that. And for people who don't know, the Solera system is very similar, my understanding anyway, is that it's very similar to the way that I used to cook stew when I was a student, in as much as it's like a never-ending pot. You never empty it, you just keep topping it up, so there's a there's always a bit of something that is there before, isn't it? Is that a fair way of saying it?
That's a really good description, actually. We set up the Sonera back in the late 90s. We filled it with 15-year-old Glenfiddich back in the late 90s. We never, ever take out more than half of the contents of that vat, and it holds about 37,000 litres, so that's a lot of whiskey in the vat. And every time we take a batch out to bottle, we then top it back up again with Glenfiddich, 15-year-old Glenfiddich from sherry casks, American oak casks that have had bourbon in them, and also American oak casks that are completely new, virgin American oak. So, your never-ending stew is a good analogy.
I think the Glenfiddich would both be a bit tastier and also a lot safer than mine.
Yeah, probably.
Because I will be honest, and this is a bit gross to say, I suppose, towards the end of it, I was finding that the stew was becoming less of an attractive thing to eat, but it did become a very good adhesive. But enough about that. Jamie, thank you ever so much for talking to me. It's been a real pleasure.
And Jim, you're very, very welcome.
Good luck with everything that's coming up as well. I look forward to these new releases and the expansion of the Age of Discovery as it happens.
Well, as sometimes does happen to me, there I was, Monday night, podcast recorded. Well, as much as I can get things done with the way my life is at the moment, and near enough ready to go. And then what I normally do is listen through it on the Tuesday, make sure it's okay, ready to go out Tuesday night. But as often happens, something then turns up last minute and I have to quickly sneak it in. And that's what's happened today. I've been wanting to talk to Jamie Milne for some time, and then I managed to do it. And I really enjoyed talking to him. But he wasn't the only person I've been trying to talk to for some time. Another person was Blair Bowman. Now, Blair Bowman, no disrespect, it might be a name that you're not too familiar with, but I'm sure a lot of listeners will be if I give him his more well-known name, which is Worldwide Whiskey Day. He's been quite a presence, both on Twitter and on Facebook, and it's a project that has really taken off. And Worldwide Whiskey Day is happening next Tuesday. This podcast tends to come out on a Tuesday night. I don't know for certain yet, but I've got a sneaky feeling that Worldwide Whiskey Day might ironically delay the next episode of the Malted Muse podcast, because I think I might be a little bit busy celebrating that day. It was great talking to him. As always, audio quality not perfect. It was on the hoof, but there you go. So, I'm not going to say any more about it. Details of Worldwide Whiskey Day are in my chat with him and also on his website. Visit my website, you'll find a link to his website. This is my chat with Blair Bowman.
Blair, it's ever so nice to talk to you. We're going to talk very briefly here about World Whiskey Day, because that is nearly upon us. In fact, if my understanding is right, it should be 27th of March?
Yeah, that's 1 week today.
1 week today, from the point we're recording this. How long have you been working on it for?
Since June, last year.
Right, and what sort of response have you had for it? What's the philosophy behind it?
It's absolutely phenomenal. It's all kind of spread virally through blogs, Twitter, Facebook and stuff. And now I've just actually updated the map on the site, and I'm now at 16,142 expected attendees.
Fantastic. Now when you say attendees, that suggests that that's people coming to one specific place, but that's not really what's happening, is it?
No, I've now got it's now at 124 registered events, along with individuals who have said to me that they're doing stuff in private homes and such.
Right.
As well.
When you say events, what sort of things are you talking about?
Absolutely, totally varied. There's events in lots of distilleries, actually quite small distilleries, such as Liechtenstein and Austria and Australia. There's distilleries doing events, but also events in hotels all over the world. Whiskey clubs, whiskey bars, whiskey shops, random little bars and pubs all across the place. There's even a bar actually in Kuala Lumpur, which is launching that night, a whiskey bar, and they've decided to have their grand opening that night.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I have to ask you this question, Blair. When you first started doing it, you first came up with the idea, we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Did you for one second think it was going to take off to this degree?
I thought it had the potential, but I didn't want to be too big-headed. I thought, I'll see how it goes first year, because, I mean, I've been looking at others and doing research, looking at kind of International Beer Day, for example. They've been around for a long time. There's World Vodka Day, Tequila Day, and I've been looking at how they've been doing things. And, I mean, they're now reaching quite large numbers, but that's after many, many years of growing awareness. Mm. So I thought for the first year, I'll aim for maybe, I don't know, I thought maybe 10,000 was like quite an unrealistic goal to try and get people involved. But I mean, I'm already at 16,000 and there's a week to go. So I think it could get even more, you know?
Yeah. So what was the inspiration behind it? There's two questions here. What was the inspiration behind it and why that particular day?
Yeah, I'll explain. Okay. So I was on my year abroad. I studied Spanish in the University of Aberdeen and I was in Barcelona on what happened to be World Gin Day, which I believe at some point, it was maybe like the 18th of June, around then, 12th of June. And I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea, World Gin Day. Oh, and I'm quite a big fan of whiskey already. So I thought, oh, there must be a World Whiskey Day, surely. So I did some research and found nothing, absolutely no references to anything could come up on Google. So I thought, this is bizarre. So I thought, I'll check some domain names. They were all available. WorldWhiskeyDay.com was available, .co.uk, all this was all available. And I thought, this is really bizarre. How come no one's ever done this? So I set off and I bought all the domain names and I set up a Facebook page and Twitter account. And then it kind of took off from there. So originally I'd chosen a different date in March. I'd actually just chosen the 21st of March, which is the day before, I believe, World Water Day.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Hans Ofringa quite well. I've met him a few times at events. And he got in touch with me quite early on and said, oh, Blair, this is a fantastic idea that you're coming up with here and launching with events kind of planning. I wanted it to be not just one physical event, like in Edinburgh or something. I wanted to have lots and lots of events. That was always my idea. And with as many people involved as possible, there's another idea that was behind it all, just getting new people involved in whiskey. And he said, I did something quite similar a few years back for in memory of Michael Jackson, the late whiskey writer.
Yeah.
And that was on the 27th of March. And so Hans suggested to me early on, why don't you continue what I kind of set up with that day? Because he called it International Whiskey Day. And it was a one-off event, and it was in Holland, with a linked event in London, I think. So I learned about that, and then he suggested I move it to the 27th, and I thought, that actually makes a lot more sense, because for those that are in the know, and know about Michael Jackson and his writings, it would be a nice way to kind of pay tribute to him, and continue that, and spread it, and make it even bigger.
Yeah.
So that was why I moved it to that date. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that does, and I think that's a very sensitive thing to do. Because, of course, Michael was a big character in the whiskey world who has affected an awful lot of people.
Exactly.
I was never fortunate enough to meet him myself, but even without meeting the man, his influence has certainly had its effect.
Oh, definitely.
Upon
I mean, you know, it's, the people you meet that mention him, there's a lot of people that know him and knew him very well, you know. So I think it's a nice way to kind of pay tribute. But yes, it's a sensitive issue, and I just wanted to kind of be careful about how I went about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And I might have to say, I mean, some of the stuff that I've read about what you're doing, the Michael Jackson connection with the date is something that is there, but it's not something you're making too big a deal about.
No, I want it to be, I mean, a lot of people don't know who he is, and a lot of people do. And I think that for those that do know, it's a nice way to celebrate his life and what he did for the industry. Hmm. But for those that don't know, it's a way to introduce them to him and his writings, and they can buy his books and such, you know?
Mm.
Okay. And they can now learn about him.
What about you as the man, then? What's your connection with whiskey been? You've mentioned that you've been to festivals and things like that. Are you in the trade, so to speak?
I'm a full-time student, actually. And I'm vice president of my university's Whiskey Society.
Right.
And, I mean, I've been running that now for 4 years, and actually just on Friday, we were awarded Best University Society from the university after 4 years, which we're really proud of.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
So, I mean, we started from nothing with, like, a handful of members. We now have 250 members We have tastings every fortnight with trips to Isla, to Speyside, all over the place. You know, we're really quite an exciting society. And I mean, that's how I really got my foot in the door and started going to more events, meeting more people, getting more connections. That's how it all kind of started.
Yeah. Could you, please don't take this wrong, but you're not an old man, are you, Blair?
I'll be 22 tomorrow.
22 tomorrow. So, forgive me, a lot of people see whiskey drinkers as being the older man, do you know what I mean? The more mature, shall we say, drink. Has that been an obstacle to you at all?
I mean, I think that depends on what market you're looking at as well. I actually spent some time two years ago now, in Shanghai and Taiwan. And I saw there very early on that it's not actually an old kind of person to drink. It's actually very up-and-coming young businessmen with extra cash are really spending huge sums, unbelievable sums of money on whiskey there. Yeah. As like a status symbol. And that's the same, I saw that when I was in Spain last year, that it's becoming like a younger person's drink, you know, and it's being sold much more kind of widely throughout nightclubs and stuff, whereas before people would buy kind of Alcohol Pops and it depends where you are in the world. There is, I mean, amongst my peers, my friends think it's a bit bizarre that I'm doing all this World Whiskey Day stuff, and they'd much prefer to drink a pint of something, you know, where I might rather have a dram, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is. I mean, I wouldn't say it's been a hurdle. It has a lot of people have said that I'm a bit young to be doing all this, but I mean, I don't feel I am. I think I've got the kind of knowledge to do it on social media, and I've got the website skills to kind of get it to this level. And I actually just won an award from the Scottish Institute of Enterprise for this idea. And I'm going to receive the award on Thursday, and I'll find out if I win the grand prize on top of that. And they're helping enormously, actually, to get this even to the next level, you know, make it even bigger.
Yeah. Oh, that's unbelievable. Well done. I mean, I am aware that you have picked up a fair bit of publicity. You've been in the press. You know what I mean? You've shaken quite a few hands now, haven't you? And it's...
Yeah, I mean, I have been really quite lucky in getting kind of good press coverage all across the place. I mean, mostly, I've been probably every local newspaper in Scotland now. And I was on STV, Scottish Television News, last week in the morning. I've actually got a few press events to kind of cover in the next few days. So, I mean, yeah, I've been really lucky. It's really kind of spreading. But I've also mentioned in lots of kind of random newspapers like the Times of India and China Daily and stuff like that. So, I mean, it is really getting picked up. This idea is getting picked up.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Is it profit-making?
Well, I mean, I've had to set up as a company just to be able to make things run properly, because, I mean, I've got people, I've got invoices for things that I've paid for and websites and stuff, you know. So, I mean, at the moment, it's not making profit. But when it does, I want to be able to give some of the profit to the Parkinson's Fund in the UK, in honour of Michael Jackson, because he died of Parkinson's, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is operating as a company, but that's just to make things easier, because I can't just do this on my own. There's companies that I'm dealing with, there's legal things that I'm dealing with, so that was why I had to make that decision early on.
Right. But you're not doing it as a business as such, and as you say, that any leftover money, any profit's going to be going to charity, for want of better words. To help fight Parkinson's, which is, I think, very admirable of you.
But I will need to keep some money within the company to make it, to have more publicity and kind of more marketing and such for the coming years.
Yeah, well, I was just about to ask you this. I mean, what's going to happen on the 27th? What's going to happen on the 28th? Is that going to be a day of rest for you? That's the end of it? No, you're already saying to me you want to be planning more.
Oh yeah, it's not going to be this. I don't want this to be just one off. I want it to grow and grow and grow. And I was actually at an event last week, a Visit Scotland event, where Alex Salmond was at and many other people. And I spoke to the room, and they all liked the idea, because in Scotland they're planning the next few years of Scottish tourism, and I really want this to become a special event for Scotland. Especially, I want to aim towards 2014 to be the biggest one, because there's a lot happening in Scotland that year. There's the Ryder Cup. There's goodness was what else is there, Commonwealth Games, there's a lot of things happening in Scotland, so I think it could be a great day to bring people to Scotland. And I just read that St. Patrick's Day just passed brought something like 1.5 million tourists to Ireland for that day. So I mean, I don't see why tourism couldn't boom on World Whiskey Day, people coming to Scotland to drink whiskey in Scotland on World Whiskey Day.
Absolutely, that's wonderful. Right, well, but now I must ask you this question before we go. It's not too late for people to get involved, is it? And if they
want, not at all.
And if they want to know more about you, about what's actually happening, what's the best way for people to do that?
The best way, really, is to go to the website worldwhiskeyday.com. There's tabs that explain how to get involved, how to register an event, and then you can search the map to find out if there's an event already happening in your area, and then you can get in touch with that host and say that you're looking to attend. I didn't explain that, actually. Some of the events are ticketed. You have to buy a ticket in advance, or some of them you can just turn up, but some of them are private. But it does explain quite clearly how to get involved.
And I think you join me, though, at this last little bit of saying whether you are going to an event or not, or whether you're doing one for yourself. Of course, we must ask people to drink responsibly.
Exactly, exactly. I don't want this. I don't want the 28th to become World Hangover Day.
Yeah,
that's not absolutely. That's not the purpose of this at all. I want people to enjoy responsibly and to drink. Not obviously, don't drink a whole bottle of whiskey. To drink maybe one whiskey and just savor it, you know.
Yeah.
But introduce friends. Just share it with friends. Introduce friends to whiskey that might not normally have whiskey. I just want it to be a day of celebration for whiskey and for the whiskey industry and in memory of Michael Jackson.
Brilliant. Okay, so we've got the day going there. You've organised this day. There's lots of events, all this sort of stuff going on. Are there any special bottlings as well?
Yes, I got in touch with Master of Malt quite early on, and they loved the idea, especially Ben and his team. And together, they helped me produce a World Whiskey Day whiskey. For people to buy, and they can celebrate and drink whiskey on that day with this special blend that I created myself.
That's marvellous.
Yeah.
And but you can get that, of course, from the Master of Malt website.
You can get it direct from masterofmalt.com, and actually I just checked the delivery page, and you can, even if you buy it today, you could still get it to America, Japan, China, Australia, all within time for to be able to drink it on the 27th itself.
Marvellous. Well, come the 27th, I will guarantee I will pour myself out a dram, no matter where I am at the time. I'll do a toast to yourself, of course a toast to Michael Jackson, and a toast to all other whiskey drinkers who are joining us on that day. And
yep.
Thank you ever so much for organising what looks to be like a cracking day in our calendar.
Well, thank you for your support, I really appreciate it.
All right. And of course, I will be putting a link to your website on my website and in the,
okay.
In the episode notes.
Well, thank you again for listening to this episode of the More to Muse podcast. If you haven't heard them already, there is a back catalogue of other episodes available on iTunes. And if anybody wants to contact me, they can do so. My email address is jim@themaltedmuse.com. There's the website, www.themaltedmuse.com. And there's also Twitter, @themaltedmuse. So thank you again for listening. I hope you'll listen next week. And until then, thank you and goodbye.